and we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we explore the topic of universal health care, a hotly debated question. My guest, Rosemary Day, has been a fierce advocate for universal health care for more than a quarter century. Her long stint in healthcare and related fields includes her stint as the founding deputy director and chief operating officer of the Health Connector in the state of Massachusetts, which in many ways served as the primary model for the Affordable Care Act, which came just a few years later. Currently, she is founder and CEO of Day Health Strategies, which advocates for national health care reform. Her new book is called Marching Toward Coverage: How Women Can Lead the Fight for Universal Health Care, published by Beacon Press. I began my interview with Rosemary Day by asking her to explain what prompted her to write this book, which is both political and also deeply personal.
Well, I think my personal story became that tipping point. My initial impetus to do the book was the election of Donald Trump in 2016 on a platform of repealing the Affordable Care Act. He made that a promise of something he was going to do on day one. And because he had Congress on his side, all the Republican leaders were saying the same thing. I actually thought that the ACA was a goner, frankly, and I was wanting to do something to defend what I thought really could be a good solution for our country if people understood it better. That was my theory. So I started with that, and then I went on to the Women's March in early 2017, was so inspired by that march on Washington, including all around the country and the world, and that powerful, peaceful protest built my sense of like possibility that if we come together in this way, we can push back and push forward for change. So that was all percolating. And then literally right after the Women's March, I went in for my biopsy that I had kind of deferred, post-mammogram looking questionable, and found out that I had cancer, breast cancer. And so I was very fortunate in that it was found so early that I could be treated and be back on my feet within a matter of months. And also, you know, didn't face the risk of death, honestly. And so while I was, you know, alarmed and scared about the diagnosis, when it played out, I was actually one of the lucky ones. And so I started asking the question of my doctors and others in the system, what would have happened if I hadn't got, you know, that mammogram and been diagnosed so early? Because, you know, I had insurance coverage and I was always being prodded by the practitioners to come in, you know, because I'm a busy person. So I would kind of delay, but because I was in the system, they were kind of already taking care of me, and it really mattered. And this hit home in such a deep way for me, because here's the thing. When I had to tell my kids who were in high school and elementary school at the time that this was my diagnosis, I could immediately tell them that it was completely treatable and that I would be fine at the other end. I didn't have to tell them I might die. I mean, because you need to be honest with your kids. And to have that be the situation was purely because I had the coverage and the preventive, you know, scans that allowed me to get treatment early enough to make that difference. And that is what became my tipping point, as I say, because I always believed there should be universal health care. But the fact that my doctors could tell me the stories of the women who have delayed finding out, or when they do find out, they'll delay treatment because they can't afford it. And then they are then risking death unnecessarily. That became, I said, if I come out the other side healthy enough to do more, then I have to write this book, because this is a humanitarian issue. It shouldn't be this terribly, horribly politicized issue. These are our lives, and I lived it.
I wonder if you could explain, I mean, you've already touched on how powerful the Women's March on Washington was, I mean, in terms of its inspiration to you. But beyond that, I think it's important for us to understand why you are choosing to tilt the focus of the book, at least to some extent, towards engaging women. when, of course, I think anybody, including you, would agree that this is something that affects all of us, and all of us, men and women alike, need to be part of this discussion and part of this struggle one way or another. In what way do you see a sort of special need for women to be more of a part of this than they have been in the past?
Well, you know, I thought long and hard about this because I know women have extremely full plates, and the idea to say, okay, let's step up, you know, and be expecting people to do more, you know, could certainly be viewed as that's not helpful. But I really go back, and you talk about, hey, this is intensely personal and it's also political. Well, it really goes back to that feminist mantra of the personal is political. And I wanted to strengthen the connection in people's minds between these burdens that you're carrying personally, the having to worry about whether you can get healthcare coverage and treatments. That isn't something that can be solved at the personal level. It has to be solved at the societal level. And for that to happen, we have to have political change. And I've long been a fan of having, you know, just for equality's sake, more women elected to higher office. So that had been another piece of my life. But I started to put the whole thing together. And as I looked into it, you see that women do vote more for a healthcare platform for candidates who are supporting things like that than men do on average. Now, that breaks down by party. On the Democratic side, it's fairly equal. But as you move to independents and Republicans, there's a definite gender gap there. And I thought, what if we harnessed the power of some of that gap and said, okay, we need to come together and push to make this happen. We're the only country that hasn't. Why is that? Where what's been missing? And my thesis was that it's this women having more power piece that's been missing.
I think it's also interesting, an observation that you make that I want you to talk about and maybe defend to some extent. And that is when you talk about the fact that when it comes to so many issues, and healthcare is certainly among them, we are obviously at the moment living in a highly polarized environment where talking about just about anything related to public policy can be a little bit scary if you are averse to conflict with people that disagree with you. And just in general, we seem to right now really have difficulty talking about anything with people with whom we disagree. And you go so far as to say in your book that women tend to be reluctant to enter arenas of high polarization, and that women appreciate having common ground, want to find common ground, and an issue like healthcare is just really messy. And one is not likely to find common ground, or not easily find common ground. You may have to really engage in some difficult conflict and tense conversations before you get there to common ground. I wonder if you could just say a word about that, because I think it's not that I disagree with you, but I think whenever one makes any kind of generalization along gender lines, like women don't like conflict, or women are the only people who know how to build, you know, bridges of understanding, I mean, you're running the risk of attracting criticism. I wonder what went through your mind, and in what way you thought about this as you shaped these kind of statements about women in general.
Yeah, so of course it's really risky to make these kinds of generalizations. I understand that. I'm certainly writing from my experience, and that's not just my personal experience, but the world in which I've lived, including going to that first women's march in Washington, where you know, and surveys were done. So many women who were there for the first time. They had never seen themselves as quote unquote activists. And this, and I'm speaking about a lot of white women, to be honest, because they were middle-class white women were living lives of relative comfort and privilege. And so didn't necessarily need to be out on the streets advocating for something, unless they were very much allies of the Black Lives Matter movement, which, frankly, in early 2017 was not as prevalent in terms of where we were finding those allies. So I was writing about trying to think about the people I'd had conversations with, like, why had they held back? And there were so many reasons for it. And yes, some of it's the comfort, but also how people were raised. To not make waves, you know, to be socially acceptable, especially if you wanted to move up the corporate ladder or, you know, engage trying to get your foot in the door to get into a corporate boardroom, things like that. A lot of women felt like they can't make waves. And there's a great book, Good and Mad, by Rebecca Traister, that I highly recommend, that talks about the change women have been able to make when they get mad enough and they come together. It's not all, you know, I can't speak for every single woman, of course not, but just kind of looking at the preponderance of, like, where's the culture and, you know, what happened to that push back when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was arguing her cases, you know, in the late 60s and 70s and all of the things that were happening. What happened to the broader culture, again, for speaking a lot about white women who had made it to the middle class and stuff? Where was that push coming from? And it seemed like from the reading and research I did and the conversations that women had kind of pulled back in many ways, because of all the things they were dealing with to try and, you know, do work and do home stuff and all that. And maybe didn't, again, see themselves as activists. And it's like, well, we do have to keep the pressure on. You know, one of the statistics I put in the book is that women don't give as many political donations. So, you know, we give about a third of them, men give two thirds, and that's both in dollar amount and volume. And so I said, well, why is that? How is it that women aren't seeing themselves as political actors? You know, yes, sure, maybe you don't want to run for office, but is there a reluctance to enter the arena even in other ways? And so I'm encouraging people to see themselves differently, you know. Mm-hmm. When the women came to the march and they said, what's next? I wanted to provide the what's next for those people who were asking that question.
Right. And of course, one of the most dramatic moves in the midterm election was the huge influx of women seeking and gaining political office in unprecedented numbers, which is, of course, part of what you're talking about. But you're not just talking about women running for office, you're also talking about more and more women engaging in this issue from where they are, from the lives that they are living right now. And you're also, go ahead.
When I want to throw in another really big thing that happened towards the end of 2017 and was kind of the last straw that fully galvanized me, because you can have the idea to write a book, but, you know, I also have a lot of other things on my plate. So if you're going to get serious about it, you know, you have to make some tough choices about your own life and, you know, what you're going to prioritize. Well, the Me Too movement came roaring up with what happened in late 2017, first with the Harvey Weinstein and then the whole domino effect of all of these women coming out and saying, oh, that happened to me. Oh, that happened to me, including friends of mine. I mean, it was like so powerful. And day after day, industry after industry, you see that there had been this systemic problem that was causing a lot of women who had thought they were equal to just sort of quietly, you know, off-ramp, go to a different job, get out of the way, get away from the perpetrator, whatever it was. And it was like, what is going on? There's this, like, toxicity that everyone was sort of dealing with, but privately. And so that was another part of the intellectual development for me, was like, how many things are we taking in and dealing with privately, or just maybe talking about with some friends, but not saying, hey, to the broader culture and the society, enough is enough. And that was kind of, for me, the last straw, was there's been too much of this. Staying quiet and just trying to keep on with our personal lives and do the best we can. It's like, that is not okay. And the election of Donald Trump brought that to such a head, because it's like, now we have national leadership that is essentially behaving this way, and others around him are condoning it. And, you know, you can tell, I was so upset by all that. My arena is the healthcare world, so I was applying, like, what's happening culturally back over to the arena I've been in and saying, is this part of the reason? Have we just held back and not demanded more? So that's part of it. Now, I know that conflict, I am not somebody who seeks out conflict. I prefer to be a consensus builder. But sometimes conflict is called for when enough is enough. And that said, I still want to find a way to get out of making healthcare so polarized. And so how I talk about it now is really, it's a humanitarian issue. And when you see the pain and suffering from this pandemic, you know, it cries out for a humanitarian solution and to get away from the polarized, because the virus is not political. The virus goes after anyone, anywhere, anytime. And we're all connected in that reality. So I would like to take that reality and use that as a, you know, another force for change for the long-term good.
And of course, when it comes to women and healthcare, you tell us in the book that a very high percentage of women often end up making many of the healthcare decisions, not just for themselves, but for their families as well. So this is an issue that that all women need to care about, even beyond just the decisions that they are made or the constraints within which they make their own decisions. But as a wider matter of policy, this is an issue that in a sense should belong more to women than it does right now. Is that fair to say?
It is. And again, I kind of came to that conclusion a bit reluctantly because, you know, I was fortunate to be raised in the early, reaping some of the early benefits of what the feminist movement in the 60s and 70s wrought. You know, so Title IX had just got passed when I was hitting elementary school. And it meant that, you know, girls got the same kind of PE that boys got. You know, we got to play flag football. It wasn't just, oh, boys go over here and do that and girls go and do cheerleading. You know, there was requirements that we be treated equally. So as a little girl, that was my world. And I, you know, grew up in California, public schools. I had wonderful teachers who just kind of kept that going all the way through high school, math and science, like expected that girls could be right there with the boys. It wasn't, again, like we were relegated to second class status. And my own parents were very egalitarian. So I came into the world, into college, thinking, okay, that's great, whatever about the feminist thing, but like, I guess I kind of felt like we'd gotten where we needed to be. And then as my adult years have gone on and my responsibilities as a mother, as a daughter of aging parents, as a sibling, a friend, and seeing that there still somehow is this preponderance of caregiving shift to women. It's, again, not 100%, but yeah, the statistics bear it out. Women are making 80% of the healthcare decisions on the home front. Okay, you know, that is data to support the experience that I've had in many regards of my life. And it's not what I expected coming into adulthood. I was fortunate to have been raised, I think, in a very egalitarian way, but it's been kind of dismaying to see that, in fact, we didn't get as far as I thought we had.
And of course, speaking of dismay, you also express in your book a tremendous dismay over what you see as mounting inequality in our country, not just around healthcare, but around a plethora of issues over the last four decades. And so in many respects, although your book, again, is focused very much on the arena of healthcare coverage and our access to it or our lack of access to it, although that is your primary focus, it really springs from, and in many respects, the problems that you see in the healthcare sector spring directly out of this mounting inequality that has been growing in the United States over the last 40 years.
Yes. dismaying is probably even too mild of a word. I am now at the point of outrage. I was asked yesterday about Donald Trump's health care around coronavirus versus the average citizens. And I said, look, that epitomizes the inequality that has mushroomed in our society and has gotten even worse since the pandemic started. When I did the research for the book, I was surprised to find out how much inequality has grown over the past four decades. And the fact that the forces, market forces, globalization, you know, could be an excuse for that. It's a problem for so many societies. But the other societies, the other wealthy countries, have chosen to mitigate that rise in inequality through the social policies they've enacted, you know, better protections when people lose jobs, paid family leave, and, of course, universal health care. So they mitigate those market forces. We have maybe thrown a little bit in that direction, but not enough to counter that rising tide of inequality. So, you know, when Bernie would go on about the millionaires and billionaires, honestly, he's right about that inequality. We are now, when economists measure the level of inequality, our country, the U.S., is now on par with Mexico and Brazil. 40 years ago, we were much closer to the Northern European countries. We were more in their camp than, and we have gone completely the other direction. So there has to be a rebalancing because too many people are suffering in this great country of ours.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Rosemarie Day, who is the author of a new book called Marching Toward Coverage, How Women Can Lead the Fight for Universal Healthcare. Rosemarie Day was one of the architects and or coordinators or implementers of the healthcare reform that occurred in Massachusetts in the early 2000s, which served as something of a model for the Affordable Care Act. And she believes strongly that universal healthcare is a fundamental right that should be within the reach of all Americans. Rosemarie Day, yes.
Can I to add on to the inequality discussion? Because the other thing that was so amazing to me was that there's research that shows that the higher the degree of inequality, the less healthy people are. And you could say, well, yeah, of course, because the poorer people are going to be less healthy. Well, that's true. But even people in the upper income levels are less healthy on average than they are in wealthier countries that have less inequality. I found that to be an astounding fact. And so it's like we are all sicker when we allow for this inequality to be at the level that it's at. It truly does tie to our health collectively and individually. So I want people to know that.
It is, I think at some point in the book you refer to inequality as a toxic element, or you quote somebody as saying that living in an unequal society is toxic to just about everybody's health. At more than one point in the book, you describe our current system, and you're not the only person, of course, who describes it this way, as a crazy quilt, kind of a patchwork crazy quilt, in which there are lots of different elements that seek to address the healthcare needs of various people, of various constituencies, but it is not by any means a perfect solution, and it is a quilt in which there are all kinds of gaps through which people are falling all the time. And in many cases, it's people who are largely invisible to the rest of us. So in many cases, we don't even see that, or that does not impact us in a direct way where we're even aware of that. Briefly, I'm afraid, but I would appreciate you kind of describing that crazy quilt, that patchwork quilt, and then maybe where you see the most serious gaps of coverage.
Absolutely. Well, our healthcare system, a lot of people say it's kind of funny we'll call it a system because it wasn't really designed as a system. It was done on the coverage side very incrementally. So we have about half the country is covered to varying degrees of coverage, but they are covered by through their jobs, and that's either the worker themselves or their family and dependents. So that's about half the country. And then we have Medicare and Medicaid, Medicare for the elderly, Medicaid for lower income people. And then we have folks who get coverage through the Affordable Care Act exchanges. And then there's the uninsured, which is about 10% of our population at this point and growing because of the pandemic. So most people are getting this job-based coverage, but with the pandemic and the job loss, that has become more precarious. The other thing I like to note is that the folks who are getting health care through exchanges or through Medicaid and getting some level of subsidy are by and large working people, but they're working the jobs. In fact, many of them we're discovering are the frontline essential workers that have been delivering our packages, clerking in the stores, doing all the things during the pandemic that we needed to keep going, and they've been more at risk for getting coronavirus. Well, many, many of them are in jobs with no health care coverage. So where is that supposed to come from? That's the missing piece, which the Affordable Care Act started to close that gap, but it didn't get all the way there. And in particular, the biggest gaps that remain in the ACA framework are the Medicaid expansion potential. There are 12 states that have opted not to expand the Medicaid program to bring everybody up to the same income standard that the rest of the country is. So there are some very low-income people who are completely shut out of the system. And so I'll give an example. In Texas, you have to qualify for Medicaid, you have to be a family of three, for example, making under $4,000 a year. Then you can get Medicaid. Otherwise, you don't qualify for anything until you're making about $30,000 a year. So there's this huge gap of income where you have zero health care. If Medicaid expansion, if the state had adopted that under Obamacare, then all of those folks would be covered. And that's what all the 38 other states have chosen to do. So tremendous gap also exacerbates racial disparities, but that's another whole conversation. So I know we're probably short on time, but these are profound gaps that could be closed.
Right. And I think it's important for us to highlight one way in which people's health care needs are not addressed, and I think people make a mistaken assumption about this, and that is that I think a lot of us think of the ER as that ultimate safety net where, if nothing else, if you have no other course of action available to you, go to the ER and they will give you what they need, what you need, that they have to give you what you need. And that, of course, is not an accurate understanding of the kind of care that
Correct.
One can get at the typical emergency room.
Correct. First of all, they will sock you with a bill, and you know, if it becomes an unpaid bill, then that can be the sort of thing that tips you towards debt and potentially even bankruptcy. So there's that fact, and then there's also the fact that yes, by law they're required to admit you to the ER, but they only have to do the most minimal of triage treatment. So, for example, that you don't bleed to death. But if they suspect that you have some other factors, you know, they're not going to test you for those. They're not going to admit you to the hospital once they've triaged your most emergency situation. So there's a lot of research that shows, like, if you are in a car accident and you're insured, you're going to get better treatment in the ER than if you're uninsured, and it plays out in terms of mortality rates. So the hospitals are very much having to make a calculation about what is going to get reimbursed, and so they don't do the full extensive you know, level of tests and treatment that they would if you have insurance coverage.
Another factor that you explore in your book that I don't think is always folded into these kind of conversations is the matter of our social service system here in the United States. And again, probably the term system we should use loosely. But one of the things you talk about in your book is, in a sense, the disconnect between the way we deliver healthcare and the way we deliver social services, that there is much more of a disconnect in the United States than there are in many other countries. Explain this disconnect, which you also tell us has been in place here in America for well more than a century. This is not a new phenomenon by any means, but you see it as playing a significant role in some of these problems.
It does, because a lot of our fundamental health is actually not, determined by what's delivered through the healthcare system. What affects your health has a lot to do with, you know, what are called the social determinants of health. So the environment in which you live, your education opportunities, your job opportunities, all of these other factors, and racism is another one. And so how much stress is in your life? And then there's also, do you have health insurance coverage? And then when you get to the healthcare system, are you getting, a culturally appropriate care and just even appropriate care? There's so many factors to health, but it's not all just what's happening with coverage and the mainstream healthcare system. So these other factors are very much affected by our society's investment in social services, in social support. So thinking about, education and training programs or finding ways to keep people connected through a community so that there are social emotional supports to help with mental health issues. All of this kind of like fabric of society, we invest less in as a country. So for every dollar we spend healthcare, we spend about a dollar on these kinds of social services and social supports. In other wealthy countries, for every dollar they're spending on healthcare, they're spending closer to $2 on the social services and supports. So they're making this, not only do they have universal healthcare, they also do this other wraparound stuff that, again, reduces inequality and helps keep people saner and healthier on average. So they have better health outcomes, you know, societally than we do. So we like overspend on our healthcare side, but we don't cover everyone, and then we underspend on our social services side. Mm.
You tell us that there are a lot of reasons for this, which we don't have time to go into. Many of them, of course, financial and political, I suppose, in some respects, and also the fact that many of the people who direct most, who benefit most directly from these kind of social service resources are the kind of people who are at a disadvantage in terms of not being in a position to move the political needle. That's often people who are lower income or otherwise do not have the resources or the connections to kind of make inroads into the political system, which makes these kind of policy decisions. But I especially appreciated your discussion on this about the simple optics, the fact that there's just something a lot less interesting and when it comes to prevention, that the social service resources that you're talking about are about preventing problems, preventing emergencies before they ever occur. And nobody creates Emmy Award-winning television shows about that or movies of the week or whatever. I mean, it is.
Yeah, you're right.
But I think it's such an important point that this is a reality that that does not, in a sense, immediately demand our attention. And because of that, this is something that we, in your view at least, are really badly neglecting.
I think Americans love the story of the heroic save, you know, whether that was the cutting edge drug that was researched and tested and can save the life of a child with a rare form of childhood cancer or something like that. And we love those stories, and they are truly wonderful. Or the heroic save of somebody who was drowning during a hurricane or something. We love those stories. But that flip side of making those incremental long-term investments to prevent kids who've got asthma from having acute episodes that lead into the ER, those are harder to measure and a harder story to tell because it's the thing that didn't happen as opposed to what did happen. I think that's part of what makes this challenging is that you can't just tell this dramatic story and then say, okay, and therefore now we need universal health care. But I actually did try to with some of the stories I put in the book about folks who have died by falling through the cracks, who I tell the story of a nursing student who was in between coverage and ended up dying because of a condition that presented. She went to the ER and they sent her home and said, basically, come back when you have insurance coverage and we can do more tests. That should be dramatic enough, I think, to get people's attention. And now there's only going to be more of those stories because of coronavirus. Hmm.
So your book lays out a case for universal health care being a right that all Americans should expect. Explain why it is really important to, in a sense, begin at this point, even before we get into some of the specifics of policy and how to pay for them. In what way is this a right, and in what way do we, at the moment, not all see it that way?
So surveys show that the vast majority of Americans think healthcare should be a right. The how you get there does get complicated, but the idea that every person should have some amount of health care, and that doesn't necessarily mean everything. Other countries, all the other countries with universal health care, can't possibly afford to cover every single thing under the sun, but they give everyone basic levels of coverage, which includes preventive care and all the basics that we leave so many people uncovered on here in our country. But the idea of making it a right is the same idea as K-12 education. We agreed eventually as a society that every kid should be given access to public schools K-12. Now, of course, there's varying degrees of quality of that experience. There's obviously tremendous inequality. But we aren't debating whether kindergartners should get to go to school. We are still debating whether kids ought to have health care. And so I want to change the psyche to, like, every kid who's born automatically should be enrolled in some basic level of health care. Their parents can then opt out of that, opt up to something else, whatever. But every kid deserves to have that health care, in my view, as we strive to create a society with healthy and educated citizens who can be full participants. So that's a mindset shift. And that, frankly, ensuring children is relatively inexpensive. So I say we can't afford not to. We can find the money to do that. 4 million kids are uninsured in our country right now, and many more are precariously situated. That should be intolerable to us. Mm.
I wonder if we could take a couple of minutes to talk about the matter of pre-existing conditions.
And please.
And this is really significant. I think one of the points of difficulty in this is that when we talk about something like health insurance for all, and then we fold in this matter of pre-existing conditions, even when one is sensitive to the reality that might be part of our own lives, that I have this pre-existing condition, then I desperately want my insurance to cover it. And yet, in some ways, that would seem to fly in the face of what insurance, at least in its sort of most ordinary sense, is all about. I mean, in the same way that you don't get to buy collision insurance for your car after you have a fender bender, and then it, in retrospect, covers you, or you don't get to buy insurance on your house after it burns down. or after it's been damaged in a storm. In its sort of purest, simplest sense, insurance is to help insure against something that could happen in the future but has not yet happened. Does it get complicated to take that model of insurance then and then apply to it this matter of insurance covering something that already exists? How do you see us doing that most effectively, and how can we convince the skeptics who are kind of wed to that earlier model of how insurance is supposed to function?
Well, several thoughts come to mind. First of all, protecting people with pre-existing conditions is a fundamental tenet of the Affordable Care Act, and the construct of the ACA was very much to create a broad insurance pool so that all the people who could potentially, need the insurance but don't necessarily need it in that moment, so a combination of folks who are currently healthy and folks who are sick and folks who have been sick but were treated but now have pre-existing conditions, everybody's in a big pool, and that pools the insurance risk, and then the insurers can set prices accordingly. And the more healthy people you can have in that pool, of course, then the lower the prices are for everyone. So it's taking a bit of a solidarity view. But one of the points I make in the book, very much, is underscored by my own experiences, we never know what's going to happen to us. But odds are, at some point, you're going to need health insurance. At some point in the arc of your life, probably many points. But you don't know what's going to happen. I'm a pretty healthy person overall. Could not believe at 50 I'm diagnosed with breast cancer when my family had no previous history of that. So I kind of thought, frankly, that's a little bit why I thought I could blow off my mammograms, because I didn't have, family with pre-existing conditions, right? So it's a really case in point of you just don't know. You don't, and so you need to be part of that pool, even if just selfishly, because you're actually going to be the person who needs it, not that your friend needs it or your spouse needs it or somebody you don't even know needs it. But that broad pool is really essential, and that's what the ACA created. It said, okay, insurers, you still get to do business, in the private sector. We're not going to have a government takeover, but we're going to create some rules so that you all have to play by these same rules. I call them like the guardrails. It levels the playing field, but that means everybody needs to be insurable, and that works if we give you guys all the same rules. Then you compete on a fair playing field.
Right. It reminds me of an important point that you make elsewhere in the book. This is where we need to finish it in the next just couple of minutes, I'm afraid.
Sure.
But you talk about the really important need for people to develop what you call enlightened preferences. Preferences that go beyond their immediate self-interest. How do you see that happening? How do you see that being fostered? And do you see women as able to play an especially important role in that?
I do. This is, of course, I'll admit, somewhat aspirational, and it's playing to our better angels. But anybody who has had the job of raising kids or mentoring kids or, going through that whole process understands that you cannot do that alone. I mean, as so many have said, it takes a village. You need help, and you understand interconnectedness and interdependence in a way that you don't when you're living singly and just kind of being, an individual producer in our economy and whatever. As soon as you've got responsibilities for other people that, frankly, include a lot of unpaid care and all of that, the economic models just kind of break down, and you start to understand this other aspect of our lives, which is this true interdependence. So I believe that, again, somewhat unfairly, women are still front and center of that social fabric of connectivity, where we are doing trying to tie a lot of these pieces together that aren't necessarily paid, but that are vital to the health and well-being of our young people as we're raising them, and then also at the other end of life of our elders who we're caring for. And so coronavirus, to me, is only underscoring how much our lives and health are interconnected, you know, whether you want them to be or not. And so taking that view of interdependence as opposed to just rugged individualism, we've seen, you know, after the Great Depression, FDR brought, well, in the midst of the Great Depression, brought forward a lot of programs to help the broader society because there was so much devastation and loss due to what had happened in the economy. And there was a notion of solidarity around that. So we have at times in our country come together in that way. And, you know, we did briefly after 9/11 too, you know, that after that tragedy. So trying to keep that view and push that forward as a prevailing view, at least to get to universal health care, that's what I'm trying to encourage. Hmm.
Rosemarie Day, her book is titled Marching Toward Coverage, How Women Can Lead the Fight for Universal Health Care, published by Beacon Press. Rosemarie Day, thank you so much for being part of the morning show today to talk about your very interesting book. Best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it.